Thank you very much, John, for those kind words. And as ever, it's always a pleasure to be in Toronto. It's one of my favourite cities to visit, and it's a particular pleasure on this occasion to be part of the conference celebrating the many years of contributions to science of both Stu and Ray. As John has said, Stu is one of my oldest and most prolific collaborators. Just before coming here, I thought, how many papers have we written together? And it's been 15 papers that we've written together, plus one that I wrote with Glenn Torrey, which also came about because of my association with Stu. So it really has been a very fruitful collaboration, and I'm delighted to be here and be part of these activities. I'm also delighted to be talking early in the morning, early at the session, having arrived yesterday and having been awake inevitably since 4 a.m. I'm likely to have fallen asleep in my own talk if I gave it in the afternoon, so it's much better that I give it in the morning. And this talk actually came about partly as a result of a discussion with Stu when I was visiting the University of Toronto a couple of years ago. Stu had been working on some exactly solvable models of directed models of polymers that interacted. And then when I was in Paris shortly thereafter, I was discussing this with Jesper Jacobson, and he said, oh, that we could maybe do something to model an experiment that had not that long ago been carried out at the Collège de France, where they had been pulling some RNA or DNA or one of these biological molecules from a surface. And so a collaboration began, and these are the results. And if I can make this thing, Richard. Why doesn't it work? Why doesn't it go down on slideshow when I page down? I think that should next. Sorry. I don't quite understand how it works. Anyway, it seems to have worked. So this is the problem. And hopefully we'll see even further transparencies in due course. So this is the experimental setup, which will probably mean more to most of you in the audience than it does to me. You have a polymer attached. There's no point pointing at the screen, I guess. You have a polymer attached here and here, and as the piezo motor moves the polymer away and stretches it, you can determine the forces, etc., and the displacement by measuring the small movement in this cantilever by virtue of a laser reflecting from a mirror, and the movement is picked up by the photodetector. I don't know what I did then, but that seemed to have advanced it. So the idea is that such experiments provide as insight into polymer unfolding and folding, including various force-induced phase transitions. So it has some broader applications, and there are some relevant recent papers. The work that I'm going to talk about has in fact just recently been published in Physical Review Letters, to my astonishment, and is joint work with Ivan Jensen from the University of Melbourne, Bikas Kumar from Hindu University, and Jesper Jacobson from Orsay. So this is the model. We model the polymer as an n-step interacting self-avoiding walk on the square lattice with endpoints at the origin, x equals 0 here, and at xn equals l, so that the origin is the not necessarily unique leftmost point, the endpoint is the not necessarily unique rightmost point. So the self-avoiding walk takes configurations that are known as bridges. There's a few parameters to remember, so I'll note these down. Okay, so the length is L, which is the linear span, K measures the number of monomer-monomer contacts. These are shown in red here. And N is the length measured in terms of number of monomers. And the enumeration problem relevant to this is simply to count the number of N-step walks with K contacts and span L. So, as remarked there, we calculate CNKL, the number of N-step walks with K contacts of span L. And from the numerical point of view, what makes this calculation significant is that we were able to do quite substantial sized systems. There have been other works tackling the same problem in a similar manner, but they've been restricted to relatively short walks, less than 30 monomers in length. And as we'll see, the problem with that is that you don't actually see some of the more interesting features. So there are two basic ensembles that we're going to be concerned with here, the so-called constant force ensemble and the constant distance ensemble. And one of my co-authors who's in touch with experimentalists tells me that in most applications of atomic force microscopy, the force is applied, as I say here, in such a way that such systems may be considered to be in quasi-static equilibrium, and the appropriate ensemble will be the constant distance ensemble. So we define the fixed N partition function in the usual manner. Cn is this two-variable generating function, CnKl, W to the K, U to the L, where W is e to the minus epsilon over kt. Epsilon, which is less than zero, is the energy of attraction, that is the monomer-monomer energy. And without loss of generality, we're just going to set epsilon equal to minus 1, the point being that W is the variable conjugate to the interaction energy, and U is the variable conjugate to the force, the applied force. With some other variable in there to make the units of energy appropriate. And we're going to be taking, as usual, the Boltzmann's constant to be 1, and as I just said, epsilon to be minus 1. Now, for finite n, which is, of course, all we can enumerate exactly, this is a two-variable polynomial in W and U. And in the constant distance ensemble, when we fix L and N, we have a single-variable polynomial in W. And what's made us able to look at this experiment model it quite accurately is that using the finite lattice method and transfer matrix method, Ivan Jensen was able to enumerate all such walks, retaining all this information up to length 55, which is quite a remarkable feat of computing. Well, there are several things we can look at. One of the things we want to look at is the phase boundary. And the way we did this is with a fixed force F, we look at the fluctuations in the number of contacts. We define this in the usual way. We consider the mth moment of the number of contacts as just the sum of K to the M, CNKL, WK, U to the L over ZNWU, where ZN is the normalizing partition function that has just been defined. And then the fluctuation, which is something like a pseudo-susceptibility, is just the second moment minus the square of the first moment. And you'll see in the next few plots what happens when we calculate pseudo-susceptibility against temperature. And what we've been able to see, looking ahead a bit, or anticipating a bit, for small forces, we typically see a single maximum when we plot this fluctuation against temperature, but as the force increases, we start to see two peaks occurring. And as I'll show you, with small n enumerations, you don't see that phenomenon. And as a result of that, that's a signal that the phase diagram is re-entrant, and what we're going to do is calculate the phase boundary from peaks in chi. So this is the phase boundary that we're going to be determining. I'd ask you for the time being to ignore this. We believed when we did this work that we found actually a third phase, a stretched phase, but Alex Ovcharek has given us reason to doubt this. He's done some Monte Carlo work together with Yarek, and it seems that we need to look at this further. So please ignore this for the moment, but the more interesting part anyway is the reentrant phase diagram that we have here, where we go from a collapsed phase to an extended phase. And the way we construct this is shown, for example, in this typical picture. So at zero force, if we look at the fluctuations in contact as a function of temperature, that's with 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, you can see the peak height growing, and the position of the maximum of the peak coming up somewhere just below 1.5 in temperature. So if we now go back, here you'll see that corresponds to this point on the curve. Zero force, something like 1.45. Then when the force increases to 0.5, the peak becomes a little sharper. The temperature at which the maximum occurs is just beyond 1. And again, you can see how this works out. When the force is 0.5, come across to here, there's the temperature just at about 1. So we've done this for a range of temperatures and have been able to build up the phase diagram in this manner. Now the interesting thing happens when we get an F value of 1. So typically if you have a polymer of length 30, you'll see this single peak. As you increase the length, you'll see at 40 the beginnings of a second peak, which becomes increasingly enhanced at 45, 50 and 55. Some unkind person said it was lucky that we were able to go to 55, and how do we know if we went to 100 we wouldn't get a third peak? I'm afraid the answer is that I don't know, but there's no physical mechanism that would suggest that. So you can see that at the position of the two peaks now occur at temperatures of just above 0.1, about 0.12, and this one occurs at about 0.4. And that gives you, if we now go back to here, that gives you that gives you these two points on the force temperature curve. That's the first one at about 0.1, that's the second one at about 0.4, and it is that phenomenon that is the hallmark of a reentrant phase transition, a reentrant phase diagram, I beg your pardon. And this was our evidence for the third phase, which at 1.1 also looks like peak heights were behaving in the manner of as shown, though that did start to get washed out at 1.2 and completely washed out at 1.5. But as I say, that aspect is still under investigation. The other point we needed to check is that it really is a phase transition that's occurring there. That is to say that the peak values are actually diverging and not going to some maximum. So here's a log-log plot of the peak values versus the chain length for various applications of force, and you can see that they're all linear, which does correspond to a divergence. So we're confident that this is actually a phase transition. And this is just to show you how we actually get the points on the phase diagram. Here are the plots of the peak heights against 1 over n, where n is now the number of monomers, and you can see that we can extrapolate this to somewhere between 1.45 and 1.5. And we do that for all of the various force values, and each of these provides one or two points on the phase diagram. And the next thing we looked at is what actually happens when you start off with this thing and start applying a force. How do the monomers break up? How does the polymer come away from the surface, if you like? So what we did is we calculate the average span, which is just the sum of L, CNKL, WKU to the L, appropriately normalized by the partition function. Then expected, but if you think about the expected behavior for finite N and at low temperatures, you've got the thing well compacted together. Then as you pull on it, various bonds, once the force reaches a certain level, will start to break, and it'll snap forward in units of length as X, as L increases. And as the force increases, you might expect it to go through various plateau-like regions as it gets stretched, and in the infinite length limit, you would expect perhaps a single globule to coil transition between folded and fully unfolded. And also the other phenomenon that, if you thought about it, and of course we have the benefit of hindsight, at higher temperatures you would expect the plateaus that we observe to become washed out by thermal fluctuations. And the reasons we wanted to do this is that this sequence of plateaus is observed experimentally. And this is at low temperature, a temperature of 0.1. This is what happens. So at length 15, you start off with an average length of appropriately normalized of 0.2, jumps up to about 0.4, and then jumps up to the fully stretched state. Whereas at 48, you get these series of staircase bumps. And what happens is that as the length increases, you stay around this 0.2 length for longer and longer before jumping up. And so the expectation is that as N gets larger and larger, you go to some sort of jump from this state up to this state as the force increases. So that's at very low temperatures. And what happens as you raise the temperature is shown in this transparency, where we've got force extension curves for the maximum size model we have. And you'll see at low temperatures, shown in black, you've got this multi-step behavior. As the temperature increases, that sequence of plateaus gets washed out by thermal fluctuations. And by the time you're up to a temperature of about 0.2, you've got a relatively smooth sigmoid-shaped curve. The other related property we looked at is in the constant distance ensemble, we look at the average force required to maintain the polymer at a given length. So here you can see we've got average forces that are negative, and here they're positive. So if you've got... this is at a temperature of 0.6. I'll show you other temperatures shortly. So if you want quite a small extension, you have to apply not a pulling force, but a compressing force. That's what the average force being negative refers to here. So if you want something less than, 9 or 10 for a polymer of length 55, you've got to apply a compressive force. Then you have a relatively linear, almost flat portion where you've got a slight increase of extension with force, and then it curls upwards and of course stops there, because the maximum length you can have with 55 monomers is 55 when the thing is totally linear. So this just summarizes what I've just said, that initially the force is compressive, negative, when L is less than the average coil size. Next, we're in the region where the elongation exceeds the average size. The flat portion gives the average force needed to unfold the chain, but beyond an extension of about 30, the required force increases with temperature, and that's where you saw that behavior kicking upwards. And we repeated this for a variety of temperatures, and you can see that they all cross at a critical These are for polymers of length 55. They all cross at a particular value of force versus extension. And if you plot this crossover extension length versus the chain length, it's linear with positive gradient. That is, so if we do this for different lengths, the one I just showed you was for length 55. It shows that above the crossover point, the chain acquires the conformation of the stretch state. So we're going from the globule state to the stretch state, as shown there. So what's happening is that the force is strong enough to overcome the entropic effects. So this just is another confirmation that applying a force takes the polymer from a folded to an unfolded state. And forget about that, because, as I say, we're still not sure about that second phase transition, which is not supported by Monte Carlo work. Then the last aspect of this study was to try and see what happens if we try and build in some stiffness into the model. And the way we did this is to introduce a bending energy, E epsilon subscript B. So we now added a third parameter, omega B, which counts, where B is just the number of bends. So every time you have a right angle bend, you have a fugacity associated with that. So you can energetically favor or not favor those. That, of course, made the enumeration problem significantly more difficult. You have to carry three parameters round, and as a result, we were only able to do the enumerations up to a maximum of 45. But here is the average force at the bending energy, and you'll see at low temperatures, you get these sort of wild fluctuations as things snap. These are like reminiscent of these plateaus as you are breaking the polymer, pulling the polymer apart, and going from things with a certain number of bends to when they have when you're making it energetically unfavorable, you really have to apply quite some significant force, and then when it snaps forward, it drops down again, and this phenomenon is washed out as the temperature increases. And by the time we're up to a temperature of about 6.6, you've largely lost that effect. This blue curve looks similar in shape to the one we had in the non-bending case. And we can also look at the average length versus force with different levels of bending and see what the effect of that is. So that the black, so this is now at length 45. With EB is zero, we've got the black curve, so you've got this similar picture to the one you saw before. And as soon as you have a positive value of EB, what it does is it moves up the average length. That is, it makes it less makes the average length for a given force higher than it does in the case without the bending. And again, so what we've seen is that these semi-flexible polymers, a stretched state may be favored by increasing the stiffness. That's a qualitative description of this behavior. So by increasing the stiffness, we've moved from this black state up here to this state. For semi-flexible polymers, the phase diagram also appears to have three phases. Again, the third phase is in some dispute. We've lost the reentrant behavior. I haven't shown you a phase diagram here, but it's similar, except that there is no reentrant behavior. It just sort of comes down like that. We've got an open coil at high temperatures, a sort of molten globule at low temperatures and stiffness, and possibly a frozen or folded state at low temperatures and high stiffness, but that still has to be confirmed. So that's the effect of inducing stiffness. And Well, I think I'm a chairman's dream because I'm going to finish before time. And in conclusion, just summarize that what we've done is to study a simple lattice model for polymer stretching, which included data on the number of nearest neighbors, contacts, and span of unparalleled length, the force extension curve for finite length polymers, as I showed you, have a number of plateaus, and these are observed experimentally, and this is the first model that I know of that displayed that explicitly. There's just a single transition in the infinite length limit. The phase diagram was studied using fluctuations in the number of contacts. We found a reasonably accurate phase boundary. The phase diagram is reentrant, and this feature has not been visible with previous studies because the enumeration data was insufficient, and as far as we're aware, the effect of stiffness has been introduced for the first time. And as I say, this work has recently appeared in PhysRev letters, and they're aptly named PhysRev lotteries. As usual, we had long arguments with the referees to get it in, and then we got a letter a few weeks later saying that your paper has been selected for some journal that the American Physical Society publishes, an electronic journal that selects the most exciting work in biopolymers. So we felt vindicated and thought that that was a very pleasing result. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference, but it's PhysRev Letters 2007. And thank you very much for your attention.